when the British Empire and even the slave trade were still going strong, there were already people saying, we shouldn't be doing this. This isn't worth it. So Adam Smith was a prominent critic of the whole empire. He wasn't just making those arguments from a moral perspective. He also said, well, this is just bad economics.
But the people who consider themselves to be most anti-British Empire will say that the British Empire was super important.
Yes, and that's what the old school imperialists, of course, said at the time.
So Owen Jones is on the side of the imperialists.
That's right, yes.
Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch has been heavily criticised for suggesting that Britain's wealth does not, in fact, come from colonialism and slavery. Now, her critics will say that this wealth was necessary to jumpstart Britain's industrial revolution, resulting in our modern prosperity. But dating back to the euro itself, many anti-imperialists have always argued that empire was an expensive folly and a drain on national resources, with limited broader economic benefits. Welcome back to the IEA podcast. My name is Matthew Lesh, and I'm the IEA's Director of Public Policy and Communications. Each week, this podcast asks a tantalizing policy question. Today's question, did empire make Britain rich? To discuss, I'm very excited to be joined by Dr. Christian Niemitz, who's the IEA's own head of editorial, as well as the author of a new book that the IEA has coming out called Imperial Measurement, which looks at the cost benefits of empire. Welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So Christian, I suppose the obvious question here is, and people might say the IEA is an economics think tank, what are you doing writing about colonialism and empire and all these kind of historical debates?
Yes. So this has been a debate among economic historians for quite a while. It has now become prominent because it is embedded in broader culture war questions, but it's been there long before it became about that, and it will probably outlive the current culture war. It is, on its own, it's purely an economics question. It is something that we could have written something about 10 or 20 years ago. It's just that back then there would probably not have been much interest. But it is essentially about an economic question. Is it empirically true that the profits from the slave trade, from the slave plantations, from the colonies, that they were anywhere near big enough to finance the Industrial Revolution or make a sizable contribution to it? Or is it the case, as the early liberal critics argued, that the empire was more of a white elephant, more like an Aegis II of its day, or something that politicians spent money on because it made them look big on the international stage, and they used it to impress politicians from elsewhere, and maybe they had this idea of national greatness and all that, but that it wasn't an economic project. So this is a debate which has been going on for decades.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting broader context, because of course we've heard this a lot in recent history, particularly after Black Lives Matter, which came during the COVID pandemic, and since, about this need to reanalyze Britain's colonial history for the role of slavery. You get this kind of sense that's Britain's original sin, that our wealth, our prosperity, and maybe even capitalism itself.
Yeah.
You know, this is perhaps most prominently in the US context about US slavery and the Robert DiAngelo and that whole set of people. We also get that particularly in the UK context, and you see people dragging down the Edward Colston statue, for example, as some great evil activity that is kind of born to who Britain is at its core.
Yeah, and that's exactly the reason why I decided to write about this, because I remember when this happened, this statue toppling incident in Bristol, there were people, including on our side, who said, well, this is culture war stuff, this has nothing to do with us, we shouldn't comment on these things. But I thought, well, wait, if you listen to how these people justify what they're doing, they are essentially making an economic argument. So one of the organizers of that Bristol protest later wrote in The Guardian that they did this to highlight that the wealth of this country was built on historical atrocities. That's an economic argument. He was making it in a culture war context, but it is still economics. You can extract the economics from it, and that's why we have to comment on it. That is a comment on capitalism, yeah, the history of capitalism, economic history of Britain. And, it would be strange if we just sat there and said this has nothing to do with us as an economics think tank.
Now, as you've already hinted at, this debate, of course, has a very long history dating back to the colonial era itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So already when the British Empire and even the slave trade were still going strong, there were already people saying, we shouldn't be doing this. This isn't worth it. So Adam Smith was a prominent critic of the whole empire and certainly of the slave trade. And he wasn't just making those arguments from a moral perspective. Of course, he also thought it was immoral, but he also said, well, this is just bad economics. So in his day, there were a lot of the empire was sustained through trade monopolies. So companies like the East India Company were given monopoly rights. Only they could. Trade with India had to be mediated through them.
Ultimately, a disaster of state policy and monopoly.
Yes, absolutely. And he said, well, if we didn't have these privileges for those companies, we could just have, you don't need to colonize a place if you want to trade with them, you know. And we can just see that from the fact that that nowadays in the modern world, Britain trades at far greater volumes than it ever did in the colonial period with Western and non-Western countries. And in no case does this require political arrangements that come anywhere near colonial arrangements. If you want to trade with people, just do it.
Yeah, and I think Adam Smith also made the argument when it came to slavery that slaves were not a particularly good economic proposition because slaves have no incentive to be productive. Now, you made a moral case against slavery. I think there's some fantastic quotes you can find where he goes back and talks about Roman slavery and how evil it was as a phenomenon. But as an economist, he also didn't think slavery was a particularly good idea because what leads to prosperity is people being able to be more productive. And I think you can even see that. I think there's data when you can compare parts of the United States that had slaves and didn't have slaves. And it was, of course, the richer industrial North that didn't have slaves that was in modern industry rather than the slaveholding South that ultimately ended up being much richer.
Yes, the argument at the time was that the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, that they were so profitable because they could rely on essentially free labor. Adam Smith turned that on its head. He said, no, it's precisely because they are profitable that they can afford to do something as uneconomic as slavery. The criticism has always been, and of course, in a slave labor relationship, the enslaved person does what they are physically forced to do, but they have zero incentive to go anywhere beyond that. So you need supervision, and you have zero initiative, and quite rationally, of course, why would you want to enrich the plantation owner? And so that was his argument, that he saw it more as an indulgence. He thought people engaged in or people wanted to be slave owners because it made them feel powerful. So it was also a vanity project of sorts, but he thought that in more competitive sectors, it would be driven out.
What I find quite intriguing about this, of course, is that historically it was the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-empire forces who were making the argument that it's not economically beneficial at all. We now seem to have kind of made that as a slight inverse here, where the people who consider themselves to be most anti-British Empire will say that the British Empire was super important.
Yes, and that's what the old school imperialists, of course, said at the time.
So Owen Jones is on the side of the imperialists.
That's right, yes. So they would have said, oh no, we can't give up the empire. That would be crazy. It's totally essential for our prosperity. We would be nothing without our colonies. And that is essentially what woke progressives are also saying today. They're saying, yes, that was basically correct.
So kind of getting on to the cost-benefit analysis here, I think it's probably worth stepping back for a moment and coming to maybe the 20th century when the argument started to be made more robustly, that this thesis about how the empire or maybe even slavery could have been beneficial. What is, you know, strawmanning the argument? Who made this? Who put forward this idea? And like, what is the idea?
Yeah, so it was first formulated in this more systematic way in the 1940s. There was a historian called Eric Williams, who later then became the first prime minister of Trinidad and Tobago. He was an Oxford academic in the 30s and 40s, and he wrote his doctoral thesis on this idea. He said the profits from the slave plantations in the Caribbean, they were reinvested into the British economy. And that contributed to the expansion of the manufacturing sector. And fair enough, I think you can make a case for, say, a weak version of that or a heavily watered down version of that argument. The problem with it is that once that idea got popularized, it was taken out of proportion. So Eric Williams himself, he never said that that's the only reason why the Industrial Revolution happened. And he did not say that it could not have happened without slave labor. He just said, well, there were several factors, and this was one of them. So fair enough. As I said, and I think he was exaggerating, but you could make a case maybe for a very weak version of that thesis. But what actually happened once it got popularized was that it was turned into slavery made Britain rich. And then more broadly, colonialism made the West rich. So it just snowballed and became a much stronger claim. I think it could well be that if Eric Williams was still around today, he might say, well, that's not quite what I meant. If he's all Black Lives Matter activists.
So to what extent, is that true? You know, what is the level of contribution that it potentially could have made to the British economy? So if we accept that it's not zero, presumably, and it's not the reason why the Industrial Revolution happened, what is the, the best factual claims that we have here?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. So there's huge gaps in the data. We can't come up with an exact number. It could well be zero. You can narrow it down to a spectrum, and you have to make assumptions, but you can't come up with a definitive number. It's just that all the historians who have looked at, tried to add up all the profits made from the slave trade itself, and then the plantations, the sugar trade, tobacco, and whatever else was cultivated, is that if you add that all up, you get maybe it could have been 2%, 3% of British GDP at the absolute peak. But then there were, then we also need to look at the cost of it all. So
yes, let's guess that. So you've on the benefit side, you have maybe a couple of percentage of GDP, maybe a little bit of investment that happened at the time. I mean, it's then, of course, hard to say whether or not that investment would have happened anyway, or to some extent that trade would have happened anyway, that resources would not have been allocated perhaps in an even more efficient way, that Britain could have been richer if it wasn't trying to do empire and slavery. But then on the cost side of it, what were the costs of, I suppose, maintaining empire and having that system?
Yeah, again, that we don't know exactly, because we would have to know what the military situation would have looked like in the absence of an empire.
Mm.
But we do know that Britain spent more on its military than neighboring countries, even though later on, at least, a lot of the neighbors were also colonial empires. So you could say, even compared to a less successful, a less prominent empire, Britain had higher levels of military spending. I've seen one estimate where somebody said, where a historian estimated that the tax burden could have been cut by a quarter or so if military spending had been closer to the European average. So not he's not comparing it to Switzerland or somewhere, but just, you know, the average European power at the time. So quite substantial. Britain had, I think, the second highest tax burden in Europe at the height of the imperial period. So it was expensive. Nobody denies that. There is some dispute among historians where some say, well, okay, but Britain was also richer at the time and could afford a big military. So there's some debates around that, but nobody denies that it was expensive. So if you assume that at least some of the trade and some of the benefits are things that we could have had anyway, and that it had a non-trivial cost, it is quite plausible to say it could well be that Britain would have been richer without its empire if it had had a Swiss foreign policy.
So if you're right, an empire was effectively a vanity project, what kept alive then? Why did the British state and I suppose by extent the British people be willing to pay such high taxes to maintain empire?
Yeah, there's a number of possible reasons. One is just the old-fashioned public choice economics. So you had some people who made a lot of money out of this. That's undeniable.
And that's a small number of slaveholders made a lot of money out of empire.
Yeah.
They did very well. Edward Colston might be an example of that.
Yes.
But that doesn't say anything about the broader prosperity or the broader costs.
That's exactly it, yes. You had some people who clearly did benefit, and some companies, and they were politically well connected. So some of them then became parliamentarians or major benefactors, and in that way maybe prominent figures, and were just politically well connected. So it is just standard public choice economics that you had concentrated benefits. Whereas the cost was more dispersed. So the cost it was firstly taxes, military spending that I mentioned, administrative expenditure, so administering the empire, that's tax money. And then it was the legal trade monopolies where It's not literally tax money. It's more that certain goods are just more expensive here than they would be under market conditions. So it's the consumer who pays for it. But that even that, so that's clearly an implicit subsidy. If you say only the East India Company is allowed to trade with these particular goods and they can therefore charge monopoly prices, then you as a consumer, you pay the difference between that monopoly price and what the competitive price would have been. And in that way, you finance imperialism and it makes you worse off.
I suppose it's just like the arguments when it comes to free trade. So there are a small number of protectionist forces who will benefit, let's say, the agriculture industry. They want tariffs. They want quotas. They benefit individually. They successfully lobby for it. The costs are dispersed. Everyone else pays a higher cost as a result. So it's the same kind of thing. What could be some of the other explainers, though, beyond the public choice?
Well, then there's simply the jingoism argument that
Rule Britannia.
Yes, that it was this this imperial greatness that was projected on the world stage. The idea that it made a country seem powerful, and so you can sometimes see this in less so maybe in the British case, but in places where imperial policy flip flopped very quickly. So in the German case, there was. In the day of Kaiser Wilhelm I, there were no colonies initially. Or Bismarck, his main chancellor and main advisor, rejected it on cost benefit grounds. He wasn't interested in the national greatness idea, at least not in that sense. He thought, well, we look after our business at home. I don't want to own a part of Africa. And then once Bismarck lost influence in the 1880s, suddenly it switched from. Now we need to have colonies, and they're totally essential. But that just shows if this can flip flop so quickly, that shows there must be a strong non-economic angle to this, and that you suddenly have a country going from we don't want colonies to we need to be a major imperial power, and that just shows it's something about political ideology, the mood, jingoism.
Of course, Britain wasn't the only country in Europe to have colonies, even if perhaps it was the biggest colonial power. And what we can learn from the other case studies, you mentioned Germany there, which established a colonies a bit later. France has, you know, to this day, it still has holdings that are its traditional colonial connections. I'm wondering, what do they tell us about whether or not colonialism was a successful story or not for their economies in the long run?
Yeah, so the German case is the easiest one because it's completely unambiguous that the colonies were just major loss makers. That's a case where we have very good data because the colonial administrations were very meticulous. They kept profit and loss accounts, and it just shows the big ones, at least, they made major losses, had to be subsidized. And there were a few small ones that made a tiny profit, but nowhere near enough to bail out the other ones. So there it's particularly clear, and as a proportion of trade, of overseas investment, it was in the 1%, 2% range, so basically rounding errors. So there it's completely unambiguous that it was a failure in every regard.
I suppose the other point as well with the German case is that it was, because it was much later, Germany was already industrializing to some extent. So therefore it would be pretty much impossible to say Germany got rich because of industrialization. If you're going to use it's as you said in Britain's case, it's impossible to know what could have happened for absolute certainty were there no British colonies, whether or not there would have been the same level of investment. But we know in the German case that they didn't need the colonies to kickstart their industrial revolution.
Yes, you could even say that about Belgium, where this is the one case where I found a colony that was probably profitable for the colonizer. So the Congo was probably lucrative for Belgium, at least for a while. But even there, the Congo was only conquered in the 1880s when Belgium was already industrialized. So even the one counterexample or unambiguous counterexample that I've found doesn't support this idea that it's the colonies, it's the exploitation that kickstarted industrialization. It's more that you have an already highly industrialized country, and Belgium, before the colonies, did better than its neighbors, better than France. And then once they were wealthy, at least by the standards of the time, once they had reached that high level of industrialization, that's when the king thought now would be a good time to get a colony.
Yes, of course, that's very persuasive, I suppose, for the validity explanation of why colonies exist. I suppose the other interesting case studies here as well are the likes of Spain and Portugal, mm-hmm. which to this day are a bit poorer than France and Germany or the UK, but had very widespread colonial holdings earlier on. So it doesn't seem to have made them particularly rich comparatively.
No, those were the original European colonial empires carved up the whole of South and Central America. But yeah, clearly these were the places where the Industrial Revolution started much later, and that were behind the Western European average. Well, to this day, if slightly less so now. But Spain only really started to catch up in the 1960s or so.
So, if the colonies themselves weren't particularly great for the home country, what was in terms of economic growth and impact? What was their impact, I suppose, on the colonized? What's the longer term implications of a country being colonized? Did it hurt their economic potential by comparison?
Yes. So this idea that colonialism made the West rich usually comes with what I call the companion thesis, the companion thesis to the Williams thesis, that it made the colonized poor. And what I found is there's some evidence for that. So that idea stands on stronger ground. It could well be that being a colony for an extended period, or being subject to slave trade activities, that can have long-term scarring effects. And the mechanism there would be that, well, if you imagine you're a colonizer somewhere, but you imagine that you anticipate that you won't be there for long. Say the climate is hostile to you. Mm. You realize I'm not going to turn this into an extension of the homeland, like a settler colony, but this will just be a place where you're in for the quick buck. What do you do? You don't care about things like property rights. Quite the opposite. You want the local population not to have property rights. You want property rights for yourself. And you just set up terrible institutions, or terrible for the local population at least. And in places like that, once they achieve independence, they may well have a new post-colonial elite, domestic elite, but that can be just as exploitative.
Mm.
And then that pattern of exploitation and extraction, wealth extraction, basically continues, just with a new local elite. So this is hard to prove definitively again, but there's some evidence for that. And I'd say that idea stands on much stronger ground than the idea that it made the colonizer rich.
This whole thesis, I suppose, comes from why nations fail about extractive mm-hmm. institutions.
Yeah.
That's the reason why countries aren't as successful. And if you're colonized, you're more likely to have those extractive institutions. Although, of course, that's not universal. So, I mean, in terms of the settler colonies, you know, particularly the English ones, Australia, Canada, ultimately the United States, New Zealand, ended up being hugely successful because good institutions were set up. And I suppose the question then is, it's difficult to answer, which is how much of a straitjacket are those exploitive institutions? So if you kind of, I suppose, take a historical institutionalist view, you're kind of stuck with whatever the colonialist administration gave you, and you can't really escape those bad institutions, or they're going to have kind of long-term scarring impact no matter what. And there's not much you can do about that.
Yeah, they are certainly a default. That's what you inherit, and changing it takes some active effort. But nonetheless, there are examples, of course, of former colonies that then industrialized and got rich. So South Korea was a Japanese colony and was poor until the 1960s or so, and completely turned itself around its institutional landscape. So it can be done. It's just that it takes an active effort, and the problem is that quite often we don't really understand what makes good institutions work. So we can say in the abstract, you know, good institutions are important for economic development, and at that abstract level, that's clearly true. It's just that when you have to put that into practice, so you're an advisor to a corrupt, poor country, and now they ask you, okay, we want to improve our institutions, what do we do? Well, it's quite hard to say what that means in practice. So that's the problem there.
I suppose that kind of brings me to my final question here. So we've established that we don't think colonialism, slavery made a significant contribution, if any contribution at all, to Britain's modern prosperity. The inverse question there is then what did? Why is Britain and the West relatively wealthy and successful?
Yeah, I try to steer clear of that question. It would be the logical follow-up question.
I mean, it's a whole other podcast that, multiple volumes of many books on this question.
But broadly, it probably is just the better institutions. And But again, narrowing that down, which institutions wear those, that's the trickier part.
Well, Christian Niemitz, our editorial director here at the IA, thanks so much for joining the IA podcast. If you are enjoying the IA podcast, please do subscribe on your chosen podcast provider. And if you'd like to learn more about the IA and follow our work, just visit iea.org.uk.